So, with that very quick set of technical reminders, I think we are prepared to begin today's session. Now, I can see your very first speaker, Clay Nelson, already on camera. So, Clay, I'm going to turn the view over to your video source, and I'll have you turn on your presentation content. So, as Clay is calling up the presentation materials on his end, I'll just remind everyone who's connecting, go ahead and send a quick message into that Q&A. Let Clay know how excited you are to be here and how very interested you are in the topic today. And Clay, as I'm looking at some of these messages coming in from your colleagues who are joining here, it looks like we have a very excited audience who are ready to take this session on in. And Clay, I do have confirmation. We have good visuals on your slides. So I'll turn the floor over to you to begin the presentation.
Thanks, Jean. Appreciate it. Welcome, everybody, to today's introductory training session, where we will provide a general overview of assessment of relative bioavailability of soil arsenic and lead for use in human health risk assessment. Today's training will cover several topics, including summarizing new guidance to support the assessment of soil arsenic and lead relative bioavailability, hereafter commonly referred to by its acronym, RBA, when assessing risk to human health at soil arsenic or lead contaminated sites. We will provide rationale to support the use of RBA data in human health risk assessments and guidance on how to measure and incorporate RBA data. We will discuss data quality objectives and sample planning when using RBA data. And finally, we provide resources for additional assistance. For more information about topics discussed in today's training session, you can email the current Technical Review Workgroup Bioavailability Committee co-chairs, whose emails are provided here. Please note that BAC co-chairs may change with time. You can also email the BAC directly at bahelp@epa.gov or call the hotline at 866-282-8622. We also encourage you to browse the BAC website, which can be accessed through the link shown here. Today's training is the first of four planned training sessions, covering topics related to soil metal bioavailability and its application to human health risk assessment of arsenic and lead contaminated soils, where today we will be providing a general introductory overview. To start, what is bioavailability and why is it important? Stated succinctly, the total concentration of arsenic or lead in soil may not provide an accurate measure of risk. Rather, it is the bioavailable fraction of arsenic or lead in soil that poses risk to human health, where bioavailability in today's context is generally defined as the fraction of total soil arsenic or lead that, upon ingestion, is absorbed across the gut wall and available for distribution in the body. Even cowboys in the Wild West understood that lead and arsenic come in different forms and that these different forms varied with respect to risk to human health. And while I do live in Texas, a cowboy accent's not something that I wish to mimic today, so I will instead pause for a few seconds to let you read the cartoon using whatever accent you wish. This image provides another example to help us understand soil metal bioavailability. The candy in the upper left-hand portion of the graphic shows a peppermint with equal proportions of red and white, whereas the candy below it is only 25% red and 75% white. Imagine the colors in these candies represent the bioavailable in red and non-bioavailable in white fractions of arsenic and soil. Note how the two hypothetical contaminated soils, depicted here by the brown rectangles, have different numbers of candies, representing different total soil arsenic concentrations of 80 parts per million and 160 parts per million, respectively. Recall that the total concentration of arsenic or lead in soil may not provide an accurate measure of risk. It is the bioavailable fraction, rather, that more accurately determines risk. With this in mind, if you ignore the non-bioavailable portions shown in white and sum up only the bioavailable fractions in red, Both soils have an equal concentration of 40 parts per million bioavailable arsenic per kilogram of soil. In the left soil, you would say that soil arsenic bioavailability was 50% of the total concentration. In the soil on the right, you would say that soil arsenic bioavailability was only 25% of the total concentration. Let's move to a bit more technical discussion. Bioavailability can be quantified in two ways: absolute or relative bioavailability, where absolute bioavailability is defined as the fraction of an ingested dose that is absorbed into the human body. Relative bioavailability, on the other hand, is defined as the ratio of the absolute bioavailability of a contaminant, in this case of lead or arsenic in soil, to the absolute bioavailability of that same contaminant in the standard used to develop the toxicity value for that contaminant. This is the definition applicable to the remainder of today's presentation, where we discuss RBA as being equal to the absolute bioavailability of arsenic or lead in soil divided by its absolute bioavailability in drinking water. This image represents how RBA data is used to adjust the total soil metal concentration. Both arsenic and lead have a default soil RBA value of 60%. This is a generalized assumption based on pooling historical observations made at many contaminated sites throughout the U.S. Using default RBA values enables us to quickly adjust total soil arsenic or lead concentration measurements by a fraction of 0.6 or 60% to provide a default estimate of the bioavailable concentration of lead or arsenic in soil. This can be done without the need to collect any additional data. Alternatively, site-specific RBA values, which can vary from the default assumption of 60%, can be estimated using simple, validated methods. Use of site-specific RBA estimates may result in either higher or lower RBA-adjusted soil metal concentrations than use of default values. For arsenic, we expect in most cases, more specifically 95% of the time, use of site-specific RBA estimates will yield lower RBA values than use of default assumptions. For lead, we expect that about 50% of the time, site-specific RBA estimates will be lower than default assumptions. These differences are due to the different approaches that were used to determine default RBA assumptions for arsenic and lead in soil. Importantly, use of site-specific RBA data will always result in lower, or in rare instances, equivalent bioavailable soil concentrations when compared to the total soil concentration, and they will enable more accurate estimates of exposure risk. So, how is risk adjusted for bioavailability? Bioavailability values, whether based on default values or on site-specific assessments, can be incorporated into lead risk models, including the Integrated Exposure Uptake Biokinetic Model, or IEUBK for short, and the Adult Lead Methodology, or ALM. For arsenic, they can adjust toxicity values, including the reference dose or cancer slope factor. RBA-adjusted soil arsenic or lead concentrations can also be compared directly to soil screening levels. And as already been noted, site-specific RBA data can be used to replace default RBA assumptions. To further highlight the value of assessing bioavailability, here's a specific example of how site-specific RBA data may be used in a site assessment to more accurately and cost-effectively meet cleanup goals. These numbers represent real-world data from an actual soil arsenic contaminated site located in the U.S. Initially, before site-specific bioavailability data was generated, it was determined that 117 acres of soil needed to be remediated at the site. EPA's Office of Research and Development conducted a site-specific bioavailability assessment and found that only 30% of the soil arsenic was bioavailable. This enabled a reduction in cleanup levels from 117 to 88 acres of soil that required remediation, saving approximately $9 million in cleanup costs. This example highlights a general rule of thumb. The lower the site-specific RBA value, the more cost-effective it is to meet site cleanup goals. So how is RBA directly measured? Several animal models have been used in the past to generate direct measures of arsenic or lead RBA. These include rats, mice, monkeys, and swine. These animal bioassays rely on measurements of lead or arsenic in blood, tissue, or urine to measure the fraction of an ingested dose that was absorbed across the gut wall by the animal, enabling a direct in vivo measurement of bioavailability. Of the animal models that have been used, juvenile swine were historically the most commonly used. However, more recently, EPA developed a high-throughput, more cost-effective mouse model for measuring soil arsenic and lead RBA. The mouse model has been shown to produce similar measurements of RBA to that of the swine assay. A more detailed discussion of the use of animal models to directly measure RBA will be presented in Training Session 4, currently scheduled for April 1st of this year. For RBA data to be routinely and cost-effectively incorporated into site assessments of contaminated soil, an alternative to use of animal models is essential. Fortunately, EPA has validated an inexpensive, fast, and accurate analytical method that estimates RBA by measuring the amount of lead or arsenic in soil that dissolves from the soil matrix when exposed to gastrointestinal-like conditions, now known as EPA Method 1340. Method 1340 measures the in vitro bioaccessible fraction of arsenic or lead in soil, or IVBA for short, where bioaccessibility refers to the fraction of total arsenic or lead that is soluble in a gastric-like extraction medium. This extraction medium is made using simple chemicals in a laboratory and is designed to mimic key parameters of the human stomach, notably running the extraction in an acidic environment in a water bath or air incubator heated to human body temperature. These IVBA assays are low cost and high throughput, and have been shown to be reliable predictors of RBA because they have a strong correlation with RBA measurements, as shown in the figure here on the right. This figure was taken from a study of 84 arsenic contaminated soils that varied in soil type, contaminant source, and arsenic concentration. Note that IVBA measurements were able to account for roughly 87% of the observed variability in measured RBA across the 84 soils assessed. Multiple regional EPA and commercial labs are already experienced in running EPA Method 1340, and new labs can acquire the equipment and reagents necessary to run this method easily and inexpensively. Use of bioavailability data fits with other soil assessment best practices, including planning and development of data quality objectives, implementing efficient sampling protocols like incremental composite sampling, and using soil sieved to a specific particle size to better represent human exposure. And again, use of IVBA assays enables RBA estimates to be easily and cost-effectively incorporated to site assessment of arsenic or lead contaminated soils. Understanding the advantages of including assessment of RBA as part of your overall site assessment is critical to its widespread adoption and increased use. Perhaps the most important benefit is increased confidence in the accuracy of the risk assessment, in many cases enabling substantially lower cleanup costs and reducing the likelihood of making a cleanup decision error regarding the need for or extent of remediation. Given these benefits, current Office of Land and Emergency Response guidance recommends that RBA be assessed at all soil arsenic and lead contaminated sites. A new EPA lead policy is expected to require assessment of lead RBA to support human health risk assessments at lead contaminated sites. Importantly, new tools and methods, many of which have been developed or validated by EPA scientists, enables more efficient and cost-effective means for assessing RBA at sites. So this concludes the first half of today's presentation. We're now going to pause for our first of two Q&A sessions, and I'll hand controls back to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much. So this is a gentle reminder to the audience. You'll be submitting your questions and comments into the Q&A window. If you haven't done that yet, now is the time. We still have plenty of time to accept some additional questions. But Clay, we do have some that came in already. So I think I'm going to start with a handful that we've gotten into the queue already, and then we'll keep going depending on how many more come in here. So a quick clarification. When you're talking about the site-specific RBA, this work is only applying to lead and arsenic, or are there other metals that this would apply to?
So is there one of the EPA panelists that would like to answer that question?
Sure, Clay. This is Karen Bradham. I can try to answer that question for you. Right now, we only have an in vitro in vivo correlation that we've determined for arsenic and lead at this time, because that's the most those are the most commonly occurring contaminants found at national priority listing sites. So the methods that we are discussing here are currently only approved for arsenic and lead.
Okay, thank you. Another question, can we always use this site-specific RBA, or do they need to justify its use first?
Again, Karen, I'll defer to you.
You can use the site-specific RBA. You don't need to justify its use. As Clay's previous slide, I don't know if we can go back, Clay, but you mentioned in one of your previous slides that it's now recommended in the guidance document to collect RBA for arsenic and lead sites. And as you mentioned here, the new EPA lead policy is likely to recommend collecting this information as part of the new policy to support human health risk assessments.
And I'll just add that the second half of the presentation will discuss a little bit more about the importance of proper planning and data quality objectives when including RBA data in site assessments. So Karen or Sydney, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume that so long as you're following that guidance, you can always use site-specific RBA estimates.
Yeah, I will pop in just with the caveat that this ultimately turns into a manager decision if they don't want to be using it. So as a risk assessor or as a project manager, you should be collecting RBA and then present that as use in the risk assessment, but ultimately that becomes a management call if they don't want to use site specific.
Okay. All right, thank you. And you all have just addressed another question. Why not always use the site-specific RBA then if it's usually lower? So thank you for tackling that one too. We do have another question here. Can method 1340 be used to measure RBA of drinking water, or is that only applicable for soils?
It is only applicable for soils.
Okay. And then Clay, can you go back to slide number 8? And the attendee was asking if you could just further clarify what this illustration is trying to depict. Perhaps if you could use a specific example. I think they're seeing both site-specific RBAs above and below that default RPA. So if you could maybe go through this illustration one more time, that'd be helpful.
Sure. So just for a simple example, if you were assessing lead at a site and your total soil lead concentration was 100 parts per million, you could adjust that total concentration for bioavailability using either the default RBA assumption of 60%, which is this middle arrow, in which case your bioavailable soil lead concentration would be 60% of 100 or 60. Alternatively, you can do a site-specific assessment of lead bioavailability. In that case, with lead, there's about a 50-50 probability based on historical data that your site-specific measured RBA value will either be lower than or higher than the default assumption of 60%. And so if you apply the site-specific measurement, let's just say it's 30% RBA, then your bioavailable soil lead concentration would be lower than both the total soil concentration and the default RBA assumption that could alternatively could have been used. Alternatively, if your site-specific measurement of lead RBA was higher than 60%, anywhere from 61% to 100%, then use of site-specific RBA would result in a higher RBA-adjusted soil lead concentration than use of the default assumed value for RBA of 60%. And then I noted again that if we were to instead talk about arsenic instead of lead, we would expect instead of a 50-50 probability of having a RBA-adjusted soil concentration either greater than or below use of default values. For arsenic, we'd expect 95% of the time that use of site-specific RBA data would result in a lower RBA-adjusted soil concentration. And again, that difference is based on the methods and approaches that were used to define default RBA assumptions, which differed between lead and arsenic. And I cannot go into the reasons for that difference. I'm just aware that that is the case.
Okay. The attendee thanked you very much. That's exactly the explanation they were looking for. So thank you. Quickly going back to that 60% bioavailability, one of the participants asked that since you mentioned the default 60% bioavailability is based on historical monitoring throughout the US, do you have any comparison to other countries, or do you think that that default 60% could be generally applied worldwide?
And I'll hand this over to Karen, but I realized I assumed it was in the United States, but that could actually be incorrect. So Karen or Sydney, do you, I know Karen, you were involved with some of that development of the default assumptions. Was did that just include data in the US?
Yeah, good question. No, it actually that 60% actually included some soils from contaminated sites in Australia. Those were our only other country locations that we included in that 60% evaluation.
All right. How about this next one? Does this method apply only to exterior scenarios? For example, would interior dust with elevated lead levels be applicable?
Karen, do you want to take a stab at that one?
Sure. Right now, we're only using and have validated this method for soils at this particular time, not interior dust.
All right, we're going to go back to that default lead bioavailability. And one of the attendees is questioning why wouldn't the default lead bioavailability be higher if 50% of the sites might have higher bioavailability? What is the reasoning behind that decision?
That is a great question. And again, I do not know the answer to that question, as I previously stated, but if one of the other panelists would like to comment.
I can. This is Gary Diamond. The default is the default to the excuse me. Yeah, the de default value is an input to the IEBK model, which uses central estimates.
All right, thank you, Gary. All right, just a few more questions here. And I do want to remind the audience you can continue to send your questions into the Q&A. I did notice a few hands that went up. Typically, it's a lot faster for us to take questions if they come into the Q&A. So if you've been trying to type in the chat and it's not opening for you or it's not working, that's the way it's supposed to work for today. The chat's disabled. You can see things I send you, but you can't write in the chat. But you can type questions and comments into that Q&A. So let me turn back to that Q&A. And very quickly, Clay, can you remind everyone what is the default bioavailability for arsenic in soil?
60%, which is true for both
60%.
arsenic and lead.
All right. And then another question, are there site conditions that could change the site-specific RBA in the future that we should be thinking about?
Sure, I'll the short answer is yes. There are a lot of factors that influence site-specific bioavailability. That includes the local soil geochemistry, which is not a static thing. Soil chemistry can change over time, and that change could influence change in bioavailability or bioaccessibility. Also, the source of the lead or arsenic contamination can have an influence on that. And there are other factors that well as well. I won't go into every single one, but the short answer is yes, this is a value that can change over time.
Okay. If performing an IVBA is not possible, is it feasible to refine the RBA using a mineral form?
That's probably a good question for Karen or Brad.
Well, we've certainly looked at different mineral forms and found that they have arsenic or lead, different bioaccessibilities and bioavailabilities. So that could be possible if that's the only information that you have.
Okay, and next question is regarding state regulations. How would an RBA inform a state promulgated standard as a cleanup standard?
So that is a good question. That is a good question that's difficult to answer today. The answer is it depends upon that particular state method. We will be getting into that a little bit more today, and I believe we'll be tackling that in more depth at a later date. But just to generally try to answer that question today, as we will talk about here in the second half of today's presentation. You have a choice to either apply RBA data to adjust the cleanup or action level, in which case, how you would do that will be dependent upon how you develop that cleanup or action level. Gary referenced the IEUBK lead model, and that is one of several models that are used to develop action or cleanup levels. Alternatively, you can use bioavailability data to adjust the total soil metal concentration and compare that to a cleanup or action level that isn't based on considering bioavailability. And we will discuss that quite a bit in a future training session. I believe training session 3 will go into a lot more detail about those differences. But it's a very important and very good question. So I don't know if any of the other panelists want to expand upon that.
Not seeing any other mics coming open. Now, we did get a thank you from the participant on that answer. So thank you, Clay. Just very quickly confirming resources. So I think what the one participant is asking, if there is a place where all of these variations or particular compounds and the methods that might apply to them, where can they find these? And I think you shared that website near the beginning, but perhaps you could return to that link.
Sure. That is. I
There
guess
we
it's,
go.
well, here we go.
Yep.
So this is the Technical Review Workgroup Bioavailability Committee's website here. And
Okay.
I assume, Jean, that we can link this in the chat as
Yep.
possibly, as well as obviously everyone will get a recording of this. So if they don't have time to jot this down today, it will be available.
Yes. All right. So Clay, I've taken that website and put it back into the meeting chat for everyone. It was also listed on the seminar homepage, and I'll cover that at the end of the session today. But I am seeing questions again. Are there RBAs for lead and arsenic minerals and sources for different chemical forms? Could we use that data instead of the default? Again, where are they going to find it? And I'm going to assume we're pointing them back to that website.
I'm going to assume that I don't know if that information is available in the website. I think if you wanted to look at that, the more appropriate place would be in the peer-reviewed literature.
Okay.
Karen, would you agree with that? And I don't know if EPA has developed specific guidance yet on the process that they would recommend using if you were to adjust the default assumption based solely on having mineralogy or speciation data, but not have measurements of IVBA.
I can answer the first part of that question, but I might defer to Sydney or Gary for the second part. The first part is there is a good bit of information about any understanding we had about mineral forms in the guidance documents that you provided, Clay, in your presentation. So if we had any understanding of arsenic and lead mineralogy, we tried to include that in those guidance documents.
I wanted to add the mineral form that you may have as a source may not adequately represent what's in the soils. And the mineralogy of the source may change over time as a result of being exposed in the environment. So that would be one reason why it may not be appropriate to try to adjust first soils versus another source.
All right, thank you. And Brad, just a quick note. I don't think the mic is coming in the best. I'll work with you to see if we can swap out to a different microphone for you in the background, but I did catch that response, so thank you. All right, Clay, if it's okay, I'm just going to take one or two more questions and then we'll carry on with the presentation.
Sure.
Can you confirm, does the bioavailable fraction equal the soluble fraction?
No. So the soluble fraction will depend upon what the extraction medium that was used. If you're following EPA method 1340, that's a very specific extraction medium. And you'll get a measurement of in vitro bioaccessibility, which again is a measurement of solubility in a specific extraction medium. But then you will need to convert that to a measurement of RBA. And that's where you get into use of these validated linear regression models, where if you get a measurement of 60% IVBA, can you see my cursor?
Yes, we can.
Okay. If you let's just say you got a measure of 60% IVBA, you would convert that to a measure of relative bioavailability. That would approximately be, let's just call that somewhere between 45 to 50% relative bioavailability, which is ultimately the number that you will use as your adjustment in your risk assessment. So they aren't equivalent, they are just correlated.
Okay. All right, and then last question I'm going to take now, although there are some other questions in the queue, we can come back to them later. So again, if you're in the middle of typing a question, get it in. You can keep going and we will be pausing again. But this last question, can you just in general say in which cases is the IVBA recommended?
I think the general recommendation is it's always recommended. And there may be reasons why you don't directly measure IVBA via collection and analysis of samples collected from the contaminated site, whether that's, cost or other factors. Maybe perhaps Sydney or Karen might have a better example of specific situations where it may not be as highly recommended, for lack of a better word, but I think in general it's always recommended. So it.
All right. I do not see anybody else coming off of mute. So, Clay, I think just in the interest of time, let's carry on with the presentation. I do see some other questions coming in, and just I will thank the audience. We will pause again. So, keep those questions and comments coming in. And, Clay, I'll turn the floor back to you.
All right. Thanks, Jean. So let's switch gears just a little bit now and discuss essential planning procedures when RBA data are to be used as part of the site assessment. Systematic planning is standard for collection of all data, including RBA data. Data quality objectives for measuring total arsenic or lead in soil should include discussion of how RBA data will be used, including whether default RBA assumptions will be used or if site-specific RBA will be estimated via measurement of IVBA in accordance with EPA method 1340. In these next few slides, we're going to dive deeper into the primary EPA guidance document for sample collection when IVBA data is to be collected and analyzed. This document's entitled Guidance for Sample Collection for In Vitro Bioaccessibility Assay for Arsenic and Lead in Soil and Applications of Relative Bioavailability Data in Human Health Risk Assessment. The purpose of this guidance is to update previous 2015 guidance to more thoroughly address application of arsenic and lead RBA data to risk assessments, to better assist risk assessors and risk managers in collecting and using RBA data, to promote consistent application of RBA data across regions, to improve accuracy of soil arsenic and lead risk assessments, and finally, to increase the cost effectiveness of risk assessment and associated risk management. The 2021 guidance discusses the importance of systematic planning and development of data quality objectives to ensure data collection will support decision needs, with an emphasis on study designs and sampling plans that use appropriate statistics and proper data application. Such systematic planning can be used for both future soil sampling efforts and for assessment of archived soils when performing a retrospective RBA assessment. This slide describes the overall organization of the 2021 guidance document. The guidance is split into 10 sections that include overall purpose, organization and terminology, rationale for collecting RBA data, a section on laboratory methods, application of RBA data to human health risk assessments, systematic planning for RBA data collection, and discussion of sample collection, equipment and handling, quality control, and important health and safety topics. Note the color coding of this slide. Sections in black denote information that was included in the original 2015 guidance, whereas sections in blue denote revised information, and those in red denote new information. The next few slides go into more detail about new sections of the guidance. Section 4 discusses laboratory methods for measuring RBA, including references to where to find more information on animal models used to directly measure RBA, a description of EPA Method 1340, the validated assay used to measure in vitro bioaccessibility of arsenic and lead in soil, and a discussion of the regression equations for arsenic and lead used to convert IVBA measurements derived via Method 1340 to estimates of RBA. Section 5 of the guidance discusses how to apply RBA data to human health risk assessment, including RBA adjustments to bioavailability parameters and lead risk models, soil exposure point concentrations, soil contaminant daily oral intakes, or soil risk-based screening or action levels. Note that RBA adjustments can be made to any one of these parameters. However, in most, if not all, instances, adjustments should only be applied to one parameter, not multiple times to multiple parameters. Section 6 details planning for collection of RBA data, including discussions of data quality objectives, retrospective RBA assessments of archived soil samples, evaluation of RBA data accuracy, selection of appropriate statistics, estimation of a site-wide RBA value using data from multiple decision units, use of a conceptual site model to inform sampling, use of soil concentration data to select samples for IVBA measurement, and information on mineralogy, including speciation, to support selection of RBA samples and methods. Appendix A of this guidance document presents critical information to help estimate the number of samples needed for RBA assessment to meet data quality objectives. Analyses presented in this appendix assume that sample and data collection needs are for hypothesis testing to determine whether or not the estimated mean RBA-adjusted soil concentration for a contaminant exceeds a specified action level. Information presented in this appendix may also be applicable to evaluation of data quality objectives when RBA data is used to adjust risk-based action or cleanup levels derived using the IEUBK model, the adult lead methodology, or other parameters listed here. The appendix includes lookup tables for sample numbers needed to achieve decision confidence objectives for both discrete and incremental composite sampling approaches. Information presented in Appendix A will be supported by a web-based tool that enables the user to quickly and easily estimate whether a given sampling plan meets decision confidence goals, without requiring the user to have a detailed understanding or mastery of technical statistics. The tool will be presented in the upcoming Training Session 3, currently scheduled for March 18th of this year. Finally, the 2021 EPA guidance document includes a series of attachments listed here, including frequently asked questions, descriptions of calculations, and presentation of case studies. Now I'm going to pause just to allow you to quickly look through these attached examples. For additional guidance, both including and in addition to information discussed today, please refer to the following reports: and additional reports are listed here. And as a reminder, for more information on topics presented in today's training session, please contact BAC co-chairs or email or call the TRW BAC hotline. And again, we encourage you to browse the BAC website at the link shown here. Building on today's initial overview training, three additional trainings are planned. These trainings will go into more detail about many of the topics presented today. Tentative dates and topics for these trainings are listed here, and you can contact the BAC co-chairs to learn more. And this concludes the presentation portion of today's training session. And I will now hand it back over to Jean for the second round of Q&A.
All right. Thank you so much. So Clay, we do have another healthy queue of questions that is built up. I will continue to invite our participants. We have plenty of time for additional Q&A with our panelists and presenter. So please continue to type your messages into the Q&A. If you have no additional questions, you can also send a message like that, that you have no questions into the Q&A, just to help us gauge if we're meeting everybody's needs. I'll also invite my panelists to come on camera if they can, so I'll make it a little bit faster in getting some of those responses out, because some of these questions may involve some back and forth. And actually, I'm looking here at the question, and Gary, if it's okay with you, I think I'm going to send one your way first. So we'll give Clay a brief minute here. So let me bring you up here to the spotlight. And Gary, I'm going to read this question out loud, as it's a little bit longer than some of the other ones. But this first question states that it was mentioned that site-specific value RBAs can be used at arsenic and lead contaminated sites. The participant goes on to say that they're not sure if this question will be covered later, but the IVIV validation and the regression equations were developed for a specific range of soil concentrations and soil types. So they ask, can you comment on the lower concentration range used in the IVIV validation and if the RBA would be over or under predicted at that lower concentration range? And then there's a third part. Does EPA accept site-specific RBA outside of the lower soil concentration range that was used in the IVIV validation?
Yes. So I'm going to, there's different aspects to this question. One is the limits of the soil concentration needed for the IVBA assay, and I'll defer that to Karen. But regarding soil concentrations and their effect on RBA, for arsenic, we looked at that question in the validation data set, which consisted of some 80 plus samples collected from all over, from various types of sites, mining, smelting, pesticides, etc. And there was no relationship between concentration and RBA. That's for a broad sample of collection of samples from various sites. Within a site, however, there could very well be a relationship between concentration and RBA because concentrations might vary geographically, which may mean that at different concentrations, there might be different sources of lead or arsenic in the soil or different soil characteristics that might affect RBA. As to whether or not EPA would accept RBA measurements outside the range, I'm going to leave that for someone at EPA to answer. And again, maybe Karen can speak to the concentration limits for the actual IVBA assay. Thank you.
Sure, thank you, Gary. So we have tested a different variety of limits. The real limitation for testing those lower concentrations for arsenic and lead comes into a analytical challenge when we're trying to test whether it's the IVBA bioaccessibility of those really low concentrations, or also in the mouse assay where we're testing the tissues to look at those really lower concentrations. We have tested some as low as background concentrations in a number of cases. As for the last question, I'll just defer to Sydney maybe about site-specific outside the lower range. Do you have any additional input there?
I'm not sure that I have anything to add to that. We have had cases where site-specific IVBA is all the way down by 10%, and it just, it's an inverse relationship. So as your IVBA goes up or down, the higher your IVBA, the lower your cleanup goal is going to go. So again, this kind of goes back to, you can present it a certain way as a risk assessor and show them what the data is showing, but the ultimate decision of what your cleanup goal will be is going to be a management decision.
And I'll just add to that, and again, Karen, correct me if I say anything that is wrong or you disagree with, but EPA Method 1340 does list maximum soil concentrations for arsenic and I believe for lead as well that can be used in the assay. I believe the main reason for that doesn't have anything to do with its correlation to RBA data, but based on the soil solution ratio used, if the soil is too concentrated, you may get saturation issues that aren't reflective of the true solubility of lead or arsenic in the soil.
That's right, Clay. There are upper limits. Sorry, I was actually referring to the lower limits when someone asked that question. There are upper limits, and those are detailed in Method 1340, and it is due to saturation.
All right. You are getting many thanks from the attendees on this very detailed response. So I just wanted to relay that they appreciated it and found this very helpful. All right, I'm going to turn to our next question. There are a handful of people who are asking about media. So we have one attendee who notes that they are brand new to this field and they're just learning about lead contamination in the environment. And they wonder, should the RBA be applied to a wetlands contaminated site with arsenic or lead?
Karen or Gary, I'll defer to you on that question.
We have not tested wetlands, and we have also not tested air or water. This is specifically a soil method that was developed.
Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but if they're talking about soils in wetland conditions, we have, I believe, some of the soils that were used, or at least assessed, included soils that may be saturated, may be under hydric conditions like that of a wetland. And I think so, I believe that's been looked at, but I don't know if there's specific guidance on soils that are in, in a wetland or hydric type of condition.
The IVBA, the Method 1340, has been used to assess RBA of a beach sediments, not saturated with water, but sediments that might be periodically saturated, but at the time they were sampled were dry. So I know of at least one site where that was done, and the information was used to estimate the RBA adjusted concentrations and used in the human health risk assessment. To my knowledge, in the validation of the method 1340 for lead and arsenic, there were no sediment samples.
I agree, Gary. I was referring to the validation. We did not have any wetlands included in the validation portion.
And I agree with that. That's absolutely.
Okay. And then again, just circling back to confirm, there's some people are still asking about media. Can you ever use the RBA when the media is water or air?
Well, I'll start, and if any of the panelists want to expand upon that, EPA method 1340 is specific to soil, and that's what's been tested and validated, in terms of correlating with RBA data. Could it be used in water? I think hypothetically it could, but EPA hasn't done that. If you recall from a previous slide, we talk about relative bioavailability as being defined as the absolute bioavailability of that contaminant in the relevant source to that, as was used to develop the toxicity standard. So in the case of arsenic, I believe the toxicity standards were based on arsenic in water. So I don't know that a relative bioavailability assessment would be of as much interest in that example as would be in the case of soil.
Okay. All right. Let's take a look at some other questions about the RBA. And a few individuals have asked about the presence of other compounds that could influence the RBA. So one attendee wanted to know if the presence of antimony would influence the arsenic RBA or cleanup value.
I'll let any of the panelists expand upon this, but I believe the answer is it could, depending upon the element. Obviously, speciation is important. Redox chemistry is important in determining bioavailability. So, that being said, it's a very, very complex system, so I don't know how much you could tease out something like antimony does X or Y to arsenic bioavailability, just to give an example. I think the answer is going to be it depends on an immeasurable other number of factors that are also at play in many cases.
Okay. And so then in general, the presence of other metals or organics in soil can affect the RBA.
Certainly, there are correlations that have been measured and observed and published in the literature.
Okay.
High presence of iron or aluminum. May have a general trend that you'd expect to see in terms of arsenic or lead bioavailability, but I don't think you can say it's always going to be the case in every soil.
Okay. Does the guidance acknowledge that possibility?
That's a question for EPAs. Karen?
Well, the guidance strongly recommends measuring it rather than trying to guess what many, many factors in the site, including other contaminants, might do to affect the RBA. There are some instances, some conditions where we know that the IVBA assay doesn't correlate very well with RBA because of certain substances in the soil. The only one that's discussed in the guidance is soils that have been treated with high levels of phosphate as an amending agent to lower RBA. But Karen, perhaps you can have other can amplify on that.
I agree with your assessment, Gary. I think testing is most important to see what's actually there. There is some guidance about testing in the 2021 guidance document that Clay has highlighted in his slides. So I would refer to that for additional details.
Okay. All right. Clay, let's go to slide 22. And one of the attendees is asking if you can elaborate on the note on that slide that only one adjustment should be made and not more.
I will do so, sure. And then, but before I do so, I will say this is a topic that we get into quite a bit in training session three.
Okay.
But generally speaking, it would be inappropriate to apply RBA data to adjust both the action level and the total soil concentration. So, for example, with lead, if you were to have a site-specific RBA measurement, you could choose to either apply that to adjust the cleanup level, for example, applying it to the IEUBK model, or you could use it to adjust the total soil concentration, but you should not use it twice to adjust both parameters. That would be inaccurate.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to a question on work with the TRW. Is there any current work by the TRW to develop in vitro methods to measure bioavailability of other inorganics or dioxin in soil, or perhaps to develop default soil? They say ABA, but I think they mean RBA values for these constituents.
Karen or Gary or Sydney?
Sure, I'll take that one. So currently, there are no plans for the TRW Bioavailability Committee to develop RBAs or to look at other inorganics or dioxin. If there's interest in that, I would encourage our regional offices to bring that information forward or that interest forward to the Bioavailability Committee. We do have a helpline. It's actually, I think, here on Clay's slide, a helpline as well as an EPA email that you could email that suggestion into, and we can definitely take a look at that and see if we have the bandwidth to expand our methods development.
All right, excellent. And I'm going to interject here. By far, the most common question I have sitting in the queue, which is an indication of how popular this topic is when can we register for the upcoming sessions? So I just want to stop before I get any more of these questions. Number one, registration for these sessions is not open yet, but it will be. We'll be posting it on Cluin very soon, and we will email all of the registrants in today's session when these additional sessions are available. And I do want to clarify these sessions are not being sponsored by IT. ITRC. So if you reach out to the ITRC team, they will not know which ones you're talking about. They will send you back to me. So these are coming from EPA, but we will get registration open soon. I promise I will email each one of you when the sessions are available for registration, which will be very soon. So just with that brief interlude, we're going to go back to the technical questions. I just wanted to prevent anybody from sending that question in again. Let's get back to some of the media. For method 1340, Clay, how was the quote soil defined?
I'll leave that one to Gary or Karen.
Well, we defined it as the less than 150 micron sieve size fraction. This is generally the sieve size fraction that would adhere to children's hands and be ingested through hand-to-mouth activity. Gary, do you have any additions to that?
So historically, the in vivo, the swine model was developed and tested to measure RBA of soil and quote unquote soil-like materials. And I think that caveat was for two reasons. Some of the soils tested were soils that had been, if you will, spiked or amended with various substances like galena or paint, and perhaps to open the doorway to we haven't tested, say, indoor dust, but maybe the expectation is it probably will do as well for those types of materials. But I don't think there's anything in the BAC guidance that specifically defines what is a soil and what is not a soil, other than it is the material that's going to be used in the soil pathway risk assessment, that is identified in the DQO for the sampling and for the inputs to the risk assessment. That's probably not a very helpful answer, but I don't think there's just any if there's anything that says this is a soil and this is not a soil.
Okay.
Materials that have been used in the validation were surface samples, and they're ultimately dried before they're assayed. But I don't know what the constraints would be on the definition of soil.
All right, excellent. Let's take a look at this question. It came in earlier. Is there a certain R2 value that is set as the benchmark for estimating soil bioavailability?
I will start by saying R squared was an important factor in validating the IVBA assay method. But in terms of application of IVBA data to estimate RBA, is not something where an R squared value would be considered once the method has been validated, if that makes sense. There would be no way to measure that I can think of to measure an R squared value of how well does my measured IVBA value relate to an RBA data point without also directly measuring RBA.
And in the validation, the EPA was looking for a method that would achieve an R squared of at least 0.8.
There you go.
Okay. Let's see. Can you derive a site-specific RBA from XRF sample results, or would that be discouraged?
The only way to derive an IVBA is via method 1340. It does require measurements of totals. Gary or anyone else, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe those total values could be based on XRF data. They could be based on ICP data as well. I don't think that there's a rule or requirement that it's one or the other, but I could be wrong on that.
Current EPA method 1340 recommends the use of ICP OES or ICP mass spec for total measurements.
Okay.
I will add here that Robert Ford is working on a paper. He did a study to see the relationship between XRF and bioaccessibility. So that has not been published yet, but it is going through like a data review and everything like that. So that is something that we can maybe keep an eye out for to share.
Okay. All right. How stable is the RBA typically over time in soil, or is it highly site specific?
It is site specific. The extent to which it's site specific, I don't know or can't say. I believe the EPA and others have looked at stability of RBA and IVBA measurements, particularly in standard reference material soils that are used as part of the QC procedures. But that's going to depend upon a number of factors. And this was something that Brad discussed earlier, but just to give one example with arsenic, if you find that a lot of the arsenic is in arsenic 3 or arsenite, and it's a highly oxidative environment, you're going to expect oxidation to arsenic 5 and I believe an increase in bioavailability or bioaccessibility over time. That's probably one example of many types of relationships that may or may not be happening in the particular soil of interest that would determine the answer to that question.
Okay. All right. Can we look and discuss if RBA affects regional background concentrations of arsenic that the site is cleaned up to?
Sydney, do you want to take that one?
We haven't really applied RBA to regional background concentrations. I think that's kind of maybe the double counting of seeing you could develop the site specific, but then you'd also need to have site-specific background that has run IVBA data on it itself. I don't think that you can just naturally apply what you've done at the site to the background.
All right, two more questions. The audience is cheering you all on. They appreciate you hanging in for some very difficult questions, and they really appreciate the ample time for Q&A. So I just wanted to pass the notes of gratitude on here. Can you talk more about the connection between bioaccessibility and bioavailability? How is bioaccessibility factored into relative bioavailability?
So I'm going to go back to the correlation. So the connection is that there's a correlation between bioaccessibility, which is a term used to imply that it's an in vitro measurement. It's not something, it's been measured using an in vitro method. Their EPA has a validated method for both lead and arsenic that would be used to convert a measure of bioaccessibility or IVBA to a measure of RBA. The RBA measurements are based off of use of an animal model to gather an in vivo measurement of bioavailability. I guess as best as I can answer is that this figure that you're looking at right now that explains the correlation between IVBA and RBA is the best way that I can answer that question.
So conceptually, the way I think of it is that arsenic or lead in soil can be in a variety of different physical and chemical states. And before it can be absorbed, it has to dissolve, has to be in solution. This is generality, but it's a sort of conceptual model I have in my head. That's bioaccessibility. So in vivo, when it dissolves in the stomach or elsewhere in the GI tract, where it can subsequently be transported into blood, that is the bioaccessibility process that's being mimicked in the test tube by dropping the soil into an acid environment. Once it's dissolved, it can become a substrate for a variety of different physiological mechanisms that move the lead or arsenic out of the GI tract fluid environment into the blood. And that's the bioavailability part. And that's why this plot that Clay showed is not a plot of IVA versus bioavailability. It's a plot of IVA versus relative bioavailability. The absolute bioavailability is not necessarily 100%. Because there's lots of other physiological factors that may limit the actual bioavailability of the metal. There is a strong correlation between bioaccessibility measured in vitro and the bioavailability of the metal relative to its fully dissolved form which might occur in drinking water. I hope that helps.
Thanks. And we did have a comment that came in. I'll just share this. One of the attendees noted that there's a formula to calculate RBA from IVBA, which is available in an EPA document, OSWER 9285.7-77. I don't know if that sounds like a familiar document to any of the panelists, but if that is, I'll have you guys look at that resource. And if it's a relevant resource, we can add that to the resources for today's session. Okay.
I think that, yeah. And just to add, since we're looking at it, to give you an example of what that looks like, the equation here, I believe, is the ultimately what a validated EPA method 1340 equation is to convert arsenic IVBA to RBA. So this would be specific to arsenic. There's a similar but different equation for converting lead IVBA to RBA.
All right, and the last question that I see in the queue before we start closing things out, we had several questions about site-specific conditions that could impact the numbers here. And one of the participants went back to that and asked if you could touch on exactly how soil properties can affect metals bioavailability relative to 1340.
I will start, and if Brad or if anyone else wants to add to it, there's been a lot of research out there in the peer-reviewed literature that looks at the relationship between soil properties and in vitro bioaccessibility or relative bioavailability. I don't think we have time to go into all of those. Again, just to give you a few examples, if arsenic or lead in the contaminated soil is in a mineral phase, and if a lot of that of that arsenic or lead is tied up inside that mineral, you're generally going to see lower bioavailability or bioaccessibility than you would if it's primarily an adsorbed form of arsenic or lead in the contaminant. And so again, that's where mineralogy and speciation comes into play. Presence of organic matter, clay content, correlations with other elements present in the soil, like iron, have all been shown to have relationships, whether those are direct causal relationships or indirect correlative relationships with bioavailability or bioaccessibility.
All right. Any other panelists wish to chime in?
I hope you can hear me okay. One of the things we've also seen, maybe not specifically with arsenic and lead from the IBBA, but you can get, depending on soil conditions, you can get crusts that form around the mineral particles, so that you would limit the solubility of, but if you imagine a particle of arsenic or a particle of lead that falls into the soil, depending on soil conditions, if you formed a rind around the outside of the particle, that may limit the dissolution that comes as well. So it's another reason why we stress that this is a site-specific factor, and depending on the sources of either arsenic or lead, those are going to affect the bioavailability.
All right, thank you, Brad. All right. Not seeing any other questions in the queue. Clay, oh, saying of it, the last one just came in. All right, this truly will be the last question we will take before we go through our final reminders today. This participant asks, if the IVBA results are negative, what default low number do you put into the linear correlation equation just mentioned to calculate the RBA that is entered into IEUBK? Putting in a zero seems inaccurate, but you don't want that number to be too high either.
Well, Gary, feel free to stop me, but generally speaking, IVBA values can only range between 0 to 100%. It's possible that you could see, and this is more the case with lead, a value greater than 100%. But you shouldn't ever see negative values, because the lowest value possible in any of the analytical measurements used would be zero. In the case, since I mentioned it, in the case of lead, where you might see an IVBA value greater than 100%, that just implies that it's a bit of a unique soil where more of the lead dissolves when extracted using the EPA 1340 extraction medium than was extracted when you ran your totals assay, whether that was microwave digestion or hot block digestion followed by analysis with whatever analytical instrumentation you used. So it's possible that whether that's a real behavior or just due to variability and uncertainty in your analytical methods that were used when measuring either IVBA or totals.
Okay, I think we're going to call that a wrap. If anybody else is going to chime in, this is your last chance. All right. So at this time, I truly see no more questions in the Q&A. So we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. Clay, if you wouldn't mind taking us back to those last two slides, just reminding the audience of those points of contact in the email hotline and the website. I put those in the chat earlier. They're also posted on the seminar homepage. I'm going to put these back up on the screen in just a minute. But if you've downloaded a copy of Clay's slides, you have this information. And then, Clay, if I could ask you to move forward to that next slide. Again, we will have several other webinars open on the topic. Once we get registration open for each of these, we will be sharing a separate email to all of the registrants with the links to each of these sessions to register. So I promise we'll get those posted very, very soon, and you can tell all of your friends about it. So before I take the screen back and do some final closeout reminders, Clay, any final thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with?
None for me, other than I just encourage you to follow up and continue with the other three training sessions, because we'll be able to do a much deeper dive into some of these topics. Today's session was primarily meant to be an overview, and there's a lot to take in here. So just encourage everyone to continue. I hope to see you in future training sessions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So I'm going to take over the presentation view and put up a screen here on my end and walk through just a few final reminders today. I do want to echo Clay's thanks to the participants who joined us. We had over 230 live attendees from all over the world, and I want to thank Clay, without a doubt, for your time and expertise in fielding those questions, as well as your panelists who joined us. Gary and Sydney and Brad and Karen and Julie, thank you so much for sharing your time and information today. The first reminder I have is I encourage everybody to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org, where we continue to collect and share information related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. When you visit CLUIN, please be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. I send that out on the first of each month, and I'll highlight new resources and online training, such as today's webinar. So when we get those other sessions open, we will be highlighting those in future Tech Direct editions. It's a completely free listserv. It has been around for 20 plus years. So if you are not a subscriber, please sign up so that we can deliver the latest information as soon as we have it right to your inbox. I will also remind everybody that there is a unique seminar homepage that's been created for today's session. So if you weren't here in the beginning, I'll just let you know that this URL, it's the same page that we sent you to when you registered. It's the same URL that I will send you to in my follow-up emails to share feedback. On that seminar homepage, there's information and contact items for our speakers, links to download the presentation content, links to get to the points of contact, the hotline, the websites, all the resources that Clay talked about. Those are all already posted here on the seminar homepage. Just make sure you scroll up and down to the appropriate section. You may find using those plus or minus icons to the right to help you jump or collapse around the content to get to exactly what you want. Now, for those of you who are looking for a copy of a participation certificate, we can issue one of those. While I don't provide CEUs or PDHs, I can give you a participation certificate that you might be able to use to get your own credit with your own institution if you fill out the online feedback form. That feedback form is, you guessed it, right here on that very same seminar homepage. So visit the URL shown in red and you can fill out that brief online form. I do read each and every submission, and that helps to continue to help us offer these sessions and improve future delivery. So I encourage you to take a moment and share that or fill out that feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. Make sure when you fill the form out that you check the box at the very bottom, certifying you were here for the entire thing. And then when you do, you'll have access to either download or print out one of these certificates. We will also email a copy of it to you, but a lot of times those emails get caught in junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download or print out that certificate from the confirmation page. And if you happened to host a viewing party from your location, if there were others who watched or joined the webinar from your space, please give them the link to the seminar homepage here, shown in red. They can go to that homepage, fill out the feedback form, and get their own participation certificate, even though they didn't register independently. So I just challenge you to share that resource with everyone who joined at your location. Today's session was recorded. You'll get an email from me in about 1 week once the archive is available. And if you're one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of the webinar, right about now in the archive above my head in the upper right corner, there will be a button that will point you over to the seminar homepage and the feedback form. You can fill out the feedback form based on your replay. Check that box at the bottom that you watched the entire archive, and you could still get a certificate based off of watching the recorded session. So remember those important contacts if you have additional questions. The email, our hotline, and again, that website to access a number of the documents that were highlighted. And then, of course, save the dates. Hopefully, you'll be back here in just a few weeks on March 1st for the next webinar in the series. So with that and seeing many, many messages of gratitude in the webinar, I want to thank everybody from the team as well as the support staff on in the background. And I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us. We hope that you found this to be a valuable part of your day and you'll join us on a future internet seminar. With that, I'll formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.